I'd gone to USC in the fall, or the early spring of 1970, after 2 years in graduate school in chemistry, went to SC to work on a doctorate. And there, I really began to get serious about my commitment to God. But I was in a lab working for my doctorate. I was in a lab with a Hindu and a Buddhist, an American Jew, an Israeli atheist with a communist background, and three Catholics of different ethnic extractions, men who weren't living while they professed, but who were extremely sharp. And I would go into my lab, my research lab, to work, spend the day there, you know, doing all my little figuring, playing with my toys, and discussing with these fellows. And I'd come home, and would just lick my wounds. Put on the band-aid. The old faith was just shot through. Well, I knew that I knew God. I knew what he had done in my life. And I needed some answers. Francis Schaeffer, at that time, I was directed to him. And Schaeffer gave me what I needed. I began to read the God who is there. And like I said last night, I got thoroughly confused. Went back and read it again, and read it again, and read it again. And began to get a grasp on it. So I go into my lab with my understanding that day, you know, my big club. These guys ask me a question. Take that. And back off. Where did you get that? And they'd raise other questions. And I'd tear into it. Schaeffer became for me a club. A way to maul unbelievers. You know, Samson out there with the jawbone. I want you for listening. And I learned something else about apologetics. One needs not only answers, he also needs love. It takes with it. The atheist just about committed suicide because he was the most intellectually honest of the group. And as I applied what Francis Schaeffer had taught me and just showing him his own presuppositions and what he really believed about life, he began to go down and down and down and down and down. He got so depressed, I got scared and backed off. I'm still not sure whether I did right or not. But SC gave me a hunger for apologetics. How many of you have read Schaeffer? Okay, what have you read? Some of the others?
I tried to read He Is There and He Is Not Silent.
Okay. One of the sermons, right?
He's also on the Moody Radio for half an hour on Saturday. In Chicago, where I'm at.
Okay. Have any of you been fairly successful in understanding it?
Yeah, after a while.
You have to listen for a while. How many of you have gone through periods of real traumatic doubt yourself in your own faith? I did. This morning, I hope that you'll be able to gain a confirmation for your faith at a very deep level. And yet, that by the time we get through, that you'll be practically equipped to go back and in your conversations on campus, use what Schaeffer spent years in developing. The handout I gave you, I'd like you to take a look at that first part there. This is something. Last night, Christopher Christian gave Claude College a lift from the edge of campus to his dorm. Claude seemed worried. Chris mentioned it, and Claude replied he was about to drop out of school. Nothing in his life seemed to be going right. The philosophy class last semester had shown that there was no real meaning to life, but he was depressed. Most of the semester he had been drunk, but that didn't happen. He had no reason to live. Have you heard of the... Chris started pulling the gospel tract from his pocket. Yeah, four people have read it to me so far. But the thing is this, I don't even know whether there is a God or not, much less this stuff about Jesus. If you could give me two good reasons to believe in any God, I'll seriously consider you Jesus. But don't give me all that warm, syrupy stuff. I want the reasons that make sense. And I'm serious about what I said. As he left the car, Claude said his family was coming to withdraw him from school at 2 p.m. tomorrow. Okay? Chris went back to his room and worried and prayed all night long. trying to find answers. And he worried and prayed all this morning. And we're going to pretend that Chris has just come to you. It's now 1 o'clock. At 2 o'clock, Claude's parents are going to arrive and take him home. Chris has come to you for answers. Can you give him two good reasons why there's a God? Why to believe in God? Take a moment to think that over. And then why don't you pair off in groups of three? I think we could do that. And take about 5 minutes and see if you can come up with two good reasons. Compare with people you don't know. If I get in your way too long, holler and I'll move out.
What's it here? And how's it need to for you?
You'll pay fees.
If
you don't get too close to the
bottom, this here keeps me smaller than I thought you'd be here.
What kind of things do you come up with? Choose somebody in your group to point at somebody in your group to share with us.
Okay.
Why don't we start over here? Who's the spokesman?
Yeah.
One of the things we came up with is nature and the order of the universe.
What do you mean by that?
The seasons changing, the days and the nights, the more you study science, it seems, in college, the more you realize that there had to be somebody that ordered it all because of so many different things. It's the order of the universe. So many different things, right? Things all fit together.
Okay. Another spokesman?
One thing that...
Did you have two reasons, or was that?
That was our best.
We talked about the fact that he's feeling... The fact that he's feeling bad, there must be something to fulfill that need. Every human and every physical need that we have, there seems to be something to fulfill it. So the fact that he feels an emptiness, then ought to speak to him that there's something around to fill that need. Pause that one.
That's fulfilling. Someone else. What do you mean by that?
That we validate that he was a person and that we can show that his resurrection is not an explanation for certain things that occurred after the resurrection.
Okay.
I was just saying that they do, you're using it as a symbol.
Right, symbol. Yeah, these are some reasons. You could point to every one of them. There are a lot more. Apologetics can have a really valid place in medicine. I'd like to take a look at this right here. The goals we're going to be working for, it's a basic understanding of the place of apologetics in medicine. Sometimes apologetics is a sidetrack, turns into an argument instead of a help. What place does it have in witnessing? And how Francis Schaeffer relates to the broad field of apologetics. How many of you have read Josh McDowell? Okay, he's got some real good stuff. How about John Stott? Well, basic Christianity. You know, really. Okay, that's another approach. How about Michael Green? Runaway World. That's another approach. Schaeffer has a certain approach that fits in with these others. There's some biographical data on Schaeffer. Central emphases of his thought, his basic method, strong and weak points, know an outline for applying his approach, and some steps to take in preparing yourself to help others as you go back to your own campus. The basic outline of our seminar is going to be on page number 2. We'll come back to the parable below in a few moments. Right now, let's take a look at the place of apologetics in witnessing. We're going to use Francis Schaeffer. What place should his apologetics occupy? I'd like to touch base with what Cunningham said last night, and then share. How many of you were here last night? Is everybody here? Okay, not quite. One of the things he emphasized is that whenever you go to college, Sunday school theology doesn't always work out too well. You enter a period in your own life where you need a deeper understanding of what faith is about. Have you ever felt like that? Here I stand with my sand bucket, looking around all the stuff I'm getting, and I'm going out of my mind. There's a place in your own life for a deeper study of the faith. Out of that, apologetics, an adequate approach to apologetics can result. Apologetics itself is giving an answer for the faith. Does anyone know 1 Peter 3:15? Can someone quote it?
Always be ready to give an answer to anyone who hopes lies within you.
Basically,
that's not how it
goes.
Can you do it?
Yeah. Sanctify the Lord beyond your hearts. Be ready always to give an answer. They demand an answer for a reason for the hope that is in you. Meekness and fear. Saint Jesus.
Good news for 17th century men. Giving an answer for the faith, for the hope that lies within us, is essentially what apologetics is about. It is not, the term implies, sort of making an excuse for the Christian faith. Apologetics is not making an excuse for the faith that you have. This guy right here has just encountered a tough situation. He's been called into question. He says, I'm a Christian, but he says, it's not really my fault. I've got this mother. It's not making an excuse. And it's also not an all-out attack on unbelievers. Well, I learn my arguments, and I go out to slay and destroy. It is giving an answer for the faith. Rational reasons why my faith works in a real universe. They can be experiential, they can be objective facts of history, they can be philosophical. But the faith that we have is real, and it touches all of life. Apologetics is giving an answer, an adequate answer to those who ask. It has a place in man coming to belief. This right here, this little celluloid, is a model of belief building. This is sort of complex. I'm going to spend a few moments on it. But I think it will help you in your own sharing of Christ.
If you're an artist, you can get this done real fast. I borrowed this from Dr. Yandel Woodman. Let's follow through what's happening here. You and I are just walking along, minding our own business on campus. And a knowledge claim comes to us. It could be in classroom, chemistry, philosophy. But a knowledge claim comes to us. First, this progression of errors indicates that we're all moving toward the future. We're moving toward the time when we will die or meet the Lord face to face in the air. In this kind of temporal, changing life situation, knowledge confronts us in time and space, and it comes to us through sense impressions. I'm sitting in class, or I start to sit in class, and I jump up out of my seat. I just had a sense impression. Somebody left a tag. A knowledge claim. Move fast. There's a tag here. Or it could be sitting, watching a lecture, listening to a professor talk to me. A knowledge claim comes through my senses. The threshold of awareness of that knowledge claim we'll call sensibility. It might have been there for a while, but suddenly I'm aware of it now. Through understanding, I get all this data and I begin to organize it into conceptual forms. I begin to piece together how philosophy, how this claim really fits into the way I think. Understanding itself receives knowledge claims. It picks up this data that's coming in and claiming to be true knowledge through three channels. One is intuitive, another pragmatic, and another personal reflective. Personal reflective is rational, a rational channel. I sit and I think, and I pick up my knowledge claim. The positive and negative aspects of knowledge are intention, of a knowledge claim, are intention. What this means is, see, I get this thing, it claims to be knowledge, or claims to be true. Somebody tells me something claims to be true. And at first I doubt it. Well, maybe this is true, maybe it's not true. Jesus Christ did not come out of the grave. Okay? Perhaps I'm a non-Christian, and I've been holding that for a long time. Jesus Christ didn't come out of the grave. Suddenly, I'm confronted by a Christian who claims to have a transformed life, and he shares with me a gospel tract about how Jesus Christ can change my life too. Okay, a knowledge claim comes my way. And I begin to wonder, well, is this true? Is this real? And I begin to stack up pluses and minuses in my head. Well, let's see. Maybe I could do some historical research. That's personal reflective. And that gives me a plus. Boy, it looks like a pretty tight case. And I walk around, I see all these other Christians, and they're happy. You know, they're victorious, they're struggling. But compared to all my friends, boy, they're moving on. Okay, it's pragmatic. It works. And then within me, there is the growing awareness. It's an intuitive thing. I just feel like this is true. That's intuitive. I feel like it's true. All of these work together to get pluses and minuses, or I feel like it's not true. Now, down here at the bottom, move it up. This decision I'm trying to make, I'm collecting more and more data. This decision I'm trying to make, when the positive elements emerge in a dominant, enduring impression, and just more and more and more and more, it's stacking up, this thing is true. Then I call it knowledge. I come to a point where I say, I know he's alive. I know that he has died for me. And I commit my life to him. I call it knowledge. I venture out. I call it knowledge. Last one. Every knowledge claim, though, is going to be verified or falsified. I mean, totally verified or falsified. Ultimately, at the culmination of death, and or a future age at the end of time. I'll move that back. What this means is, down here, I call it knowledge now, but whenever I die, I'm going to really know whether or not Jesus Christ is alive. I can know him now. I see him working, I see him answering prayer, I know what's happening in me. The Holy Spirit works within me intuitively. It confirms it. But one day, all alike, believers and unbelievers, will know whether they've been right or wrong. Now, do you have questions about this chart? This will help us in approaching Schaefer, seeing where he fits in witnessing.
Is number six there? Is that the point where you come to salvation?
What do you mean?
When you say, I know he's real, I know he died for me and committed my life to him. You know, when you have that knowledge, you know?
I have facts. What I do, I collect my pluses. I collect the things that I call facts.
Mm-hmm.
And then the point comes, I don't come to Christ because I finally get rationally convinced.
Mm-hmm.
But the Holy Spirit works in my life to bring conviction.
Right.
He uses, this is the important thing out of this diagram, he uses all of these categories to bring me to conviction. He himself is at work in my life. He'll be at work in my life bringing me to conviction. But I won't be totally reasoned to the faith. I have taken people apart philosophically, just in love, a brick at a time, and just laid them down on the ground. You don't have anything at all. And they'll say, that's right. One guy I want to share about after a while said, but I'm still not converted. You know, if you don't look converted. He had the reasons, but he didn't bow the will to Jesus. That still has to be done. But these are channels God uses.
Mm.
Sometimes we think it's all a head trip. Mm. Other times we think just a personal witness is going to do it. That's pragmatic. But you know, love, just the sense of love in a Christian group, sometimes draws people hungry to be loved. It's more an intuitive category. God would use all of this. You don't argue anyone into the kingdom. And even some people, after they've been loved, after they see the Christian demonstration, and after they know the reasons why they don't want to bow the knee to God, shared Christ with a fellow worth $60 million on an airplane coming from Miami to Dallas. He said, well, I see all that, and I see the need and everything, but I really like my life pretty well like it is right now. I'm not sure I'd want anybody else in charge of it. He got 4 and 6, built that empire in 10 years. He owns it all personally. And there he got off the plane. A 28-year-old gal, sharp, met him. Arm around the arm, went walking in. At this point in life, he has what he wants. So, there is still a bowing of the will, but these channels are used by God.
You're saying like facts would come under pragmatic?
They would come under the personal reflective. This would be more of the, does it work? Does it work for me? I may not know all about the ultimate reasons and everything, but is it working? Other questions? Using this, knowing this in my mind, whenever I move into a witnessing situation, I know that as I share Christ, he needs more time to come. Okay. I'll talk while I'll be there. And then write this down a second. I know as I share Christ that I'm going to run into maybe different kinds of barriers to sharing. As I move in, my first step, come in, Bob. My first step is I assume ignorance. I just assume people don't know about Jesus. And I move in to share about it. The major barrier for some people is nobody's ever told. So I assume that. But once I share, I evaluate their response. And that response generally ends up in one of three categories. If they don't receive the gospel, a lot of times there are human problems that stop them. A person needs some care. Nobody's ever loved them. They need to see that demonstration of love. Maybe they need counseling in a certain relationship. Personality factors, emotional factors. Sometimes it's intellectual problems that stop them. Most times, for me, it's value system problems. Personal, personal and human problems. I'm hurting, and I need somebody to help me. Intellectual problems. Oh boy, I've got questions, and I need answers. Or value system problems. Paul Little, I heard him speak several years ago, and he talked about being in a dormitory session with a fellow one night. He went from 11 until 2 and answered all the guy's questions. And the fellow finally said, "Well, I don't have any more questions." And Paul said, "Great. Are you ready to become a Christian now?" "You're not? Well, why?" "Well, man, if I became a Christian, I'd have to stop sleeping with my girlfriend. So I just wanted to tear my hair out." And his too. He had gone through all of this stuff and really gotten underneath. It was a disguise for our moral problems. Value conflicts. So when I move in to share, I assume ignorance, and then I evaluate the response. Do I need to love this person and care for them and show them the love of God? Do I need to answer questions? Or is this person really in a moral conflict? A value problem.
Okay, you've said, for the emotional problems, often loving them to that kind of thing, answering questions. What do you do when it's a value system kind of thing? For example, I've shared with my mother many times, and the main thing is to her is being a Roman Catholic and the social status that goes along with that in the community is more valuable to her than Christianity at this point. How do you answer something like that where it is a value? Or like the guy says, "Well, I'll have to put sleep with you." What do you do in a situation like that?
Bring that up in about an hour and a half.
Okay.
I would really bring it up because that would be good to deal with. Okay, apologetics works. Primarily in this category. You need some more?
Well, I just kind of this person more allies, values, and stuff.
Okay, everybody's got this. I'll just write this down real quick. Ignorance. I'm going to call it human problems. The way we'll put together something is very... intellectual problems. And then lastly, value conflicts. I just don't want changes in my life. Apologetics works well here. Uses that rational channel. But it's not totally adequate. Someone asks a question, and I rip out my great answer. Their ignorance. Jesus worked in all categories. Okay, Francis Schaeffer deals with this. Deals primarily with the intellectual. You'll find him calling, though, for a strong commitment to love people and care for them. Any last questions on this before we...
Can I finish a copy?
We'll move on.
The number 7.
Okay. How do you tell the difference between an intellectual question and a problem and one's, say, a moral conflict. Whenever one's disguising a moral conflict, how do you think?
Could you maybe get some clues from their attitude and the way they ask it? If they're just very calm and asking it, you know, and really seem to be interested, or if they're real pragmatic about it, say, well, you know, you can't believe that because, you know, just a general attitude.
Getting some clues from attitudes. Other suggestions?
Could ask him if he had that question fully answered, would that lead you to become a patient? Or would there be other reasons why you wouldn't?
That's my favorite way. I just ask people, well, you know, if I were to answer that fully for you, would you commit your life to Christ? I've had guys say, oh, no. Well, why not? Oh, man, you see, I've got... And here we're back on track. Now, earlier, somebody bring up one of those questions, and get that, and he bring up another question, I'd be beating around. Anything else?
He looks nice, but he looks...
Good. Yes, the Brief Fellowship in Switzerland.
I never exactly understand this. I think that he either spent some time in Africa or he spent some time in Switzerland, first of all.
Spent some time in North Dakota in a place called Switzerland.
I
don't know. Okay, you've never even heard of him.
His wife writes for Christianity Today, I think. She has his. Is that his
right.
wife?
His wife is writing some books. Schaefer has written pretty extensively since about the middle 60s and is having quite an impact on the thought of college students. He himself was born in the United States and went through one of the major conflicts that Christianity has come through in this nation. The liberal fundamentalist conflict. Have any of you ever studied that? Okay, all right. Liberal fundamentalist conflict occurred in the 1904. But the intense period was in the 1920s and early 30s. Due to a lot of things that happened in the American culture in the 1800s, two streams of Christianity had emerged in the nation. One was conservative and Bible-oriented, and the other group really wanted to believe in God and Jesus, but it looked like science had just totally removed the Bible. That was theological liberalism. They wanted to adapt things so that they would be palatable to modern man. We're going to have to find a new base or Christianity other than these ancient texts. In the early 1900s, this conflict began to intensify, and a lot of bitter things began to occur. This erupted in the 1920s into the monkey trial. Do you remember that Scopes trial? This is only one aspect of it. It erupted into a giant bitter conflict. And Schaefer was in seminary during some of these days. In the Presbyterian Church, most of the conflict centered, and J.G. Machen, a conservative, was head of Princeton Theological Seminary. And as the conflict finally just came to a head, Machen was dismissed. The liberals took over. And Machen founded Westminster. Have any of you ever heard of Westminster Seminary? A pretty good school in the East. And Princeton went its way. Schaefer was a student of Machen's, a very sharp, intellectual Christian, biblically oriented. And Schaefer
Saul, always John Confucius, he left under the leadership of Machen, went to Westminster and studied under him. He pastored for 10 years then in St. Louis. This was 1936. Machen was expelled. Schaefer studied under him, went to pastor in St. Louis, and became a friend of a lot of the leaders of fundamentalism or conservative Christianity. Have you ever heard of Carl McIntyre? Okay. Carl McIntyre is now an extreme conservative. Schaefer and he were friends in the early days. Then as McIntyre went more and more his own way, big party company. But two influences out of this came to Schaefer. One is a strong biblical orientation. Biblical intellectual orientation. The Bible has adequate explanation to intellectual. And the other is an emphasis on love among Christians. Biblical and learn from living through the controversy in its positive aspects. The love to learn on the negative side. That controversy left a bad taste in the mouth of the whole United States of America because the liberals had the wrong doctrine. There's some right attitudes. And a lot of conservatives had the right doctrine, but the wrong attitude. So Schaefer comes out of this. In the 1960s, he began to write relating these two. He's written now about 20 books.
What's it say up there, love among who?
Love? Oh, I'm sorry. This is my seminary notes again coming out. Mm. That's a chi for priest fellowship. That's my abbreviation for Christian. Mm. These things are going to slip out all day. I've been taking notes for 2 years now, just as fast as I can write. And they will come out. That stands for Christian. So he comes out of a strong biblical background, a strong intellectual background, and seeing the need for love. 1948, they went to Switzerland, and Labrie Fellowship has resulted. Labrie means what?
Any French people?
The shelter, the harbor. They had a ministry to the intellectuals of Europe. The young people who had undergone the giant questions, the deep questioning of the faith, had a growing ministry to these people, answering their questions from a biblical perspective. And today, they have worldwide impact.
Just to read
you. Do you know one?
Great.
I mean, right now.
They started
a Presbyterian
church there
in Whitehall. Okay. I'm not sure. It's not been in the last 2 years. He's thank you. he comes out of the Presbyterian background. His thought, all of his teachings, could be organized pretty simply under certain topics. I'll share those with you. If you wade through his books, if you've tried to, there are pieces of it here, pieces there, pieces there, and you're doing this giant juggling act, trying to get all these pieces into place. We could organize it this way. The development in the 20th century. I'm going to use a term here. That's a little time. Development of 20th century epistemology. That is the theory of knowing, the limits of knowledge, how I know. Well, the sun's not helping us out anyways.
I think it'll get better before it gets worse.
I suggest to get down here. The development of 20th century epistemology. Theory of knowing. Second, a demonstration of the superiority of Christianity. In three categories. One is how the universe came to be. Or we can give a good easy definition of metaphysics. Why there? One way to.
Well, they have to do with questions about big questions like about mind and matter.
Right. Why?
That which is not physical. That aspects of life that go beyond the physical.
Why is there something rather than nothing? That's one way to go about it. Right, those things that go beyond, that's sort of an explanation of everything. Why the universe? Right, metaphysics. A second area is epistemology. Third, morals. Now these are some of the basic categories of philosophy. And what he's done is demonstrate that Christianity has answers that atheism cannot provide anyway. A third area that he's worked in is application of Christian thought, and he's an abbreviation of Christian thought, his thought, to the individual, to the church, and to society, or the culture. I think you can put all of his books in these categories. If you want to find out where his books fit, those of you who are familiar with them. Can you see this at all? Strain of the eyeballs. And this right here is the God who is there and escape from reason. Predominantly. This is He is there and is not silent. Those are his three major books. This one is True Spirituality. If you dig into his books, this will give you a guide to what's going on. The church at the end of the 20th century and the church before Watching the World, two other books. And this is Pollution and the Death of Man. Back to Freedom and Dignity. Smaller pamphlet. That refused to be a skinner. And then Art and the Bible. What we're going to do is take a look at what he says in each one of these categories. What's he basically saying? Particularly in this one, his arguments are powerful. These are the ones that in conversation just demolish atheism. Which one?
It's like the
hieroglyphics. That's true spirituality. Hieroglyphics, the true spirituality.
What were the view on the first thing you mentioned, escape from reason, and what else?
Right. This is the God who is there and escape from reason. If you're only going to read three of his books, these are the three to read. The God who is there, Escape from Reason. And he is there and is not silent. That's what this means. He is there and is not silent. his basic contentions, the things he's saying, if you really get down to it, boil down to a few things. Number one, he says that Western man has undergone crucial changes in his approach to truth. These are exposed x-ray film. You buy it cheap from people, let your x-ray film lie around. Okay, Western man has undergone changes in his approach to truth. That have resulted in being unable to put life together. Adequately, that is. Something's happened to the way we think that just, whenever we go about, modern man goes about trying to think about purpose and meaning, things just fly apart. He can't get it together. Second thing, Schaefer says that all persons have presuppositions. What's a presupposition?
Something that you believe beforehand, or
and before
that you assume to be true.
Okay, right. Something. Before I even start arguing or doing logic, I sort of am operating on these things anyway.
Yeah.
My basic assumptions I just make. Now, I may be aware of them or I may not be. Most people are not. They just sort of pick them up here and there. Have their own little patchwork philosophy. Pick them up from your friends, from your mom and dad. But all persons have them and they affect the way they believe. And what Schaefer says we need to do is surface these. I'll show you a little chart right here that might help explain it. It's actually not a little chart. Everybody claims that his lifestyle, most of the people I've run into in college, and I am a realistic person. The lifestyle that I'm building, I base on the data of life. I'm taking all my college classes and I'm putting this stuff together. And I'm building my own lifestyle. And I'm being realistic. Well, a lifestyle is built on a person's goals. You know, what you are doing, the way you're living, really reflects the goals that you have. So people will say, well, yeah, that's right. I guess I do have some goals in life. But those are built on just realistic data, man. I've looked at life and I've considered things and I read Playboy and I put stuff together. And I come up with some real goals. Well, goals are based on a belief system. What I really, really believe down underneath. Like guys have told me, I really want to have time with God in the morning. I just really want to have a quiet time. Well, you know, good. Well, I just can't get up. Oh, well, what you're saying is you really want to sleep in the morning. You know, lifestyle is built on goals. It's based, really built on what you really feel. So I've gone through that too. Good grief. I stayed up late last night. I don't have time for God this morning. But most of my friends who don't know Christ claim that, well, my beliefs are just based on my own investigation of the universe. And I've really checked this thing out. And I've got true beliefs based on the data of life. I have considered this. But really, the data of life, the thing that we see, is filtered. These are a lot of neat terms here. I want to explain some of them. Everybody has a filter. These presuppositions, the way you look at life, these are some categories or some causes of them. We pick up some ideas about life that fit into the category of naturalistic humanism. Anybody can tell me what that means?
That no matter what man is, men are sort of getting better and better, and they can
Right, that's humanism, that's part of it.
Well, it's just thinking, rationalizing everything just without God. Thinking about things, okay. Cutting off God up from the conclusion.
No God, we got a closed universe here, it's all running like a big clock. Man is good. You know where you get these from? You pick these up. There are a whole lot of subtle thoughts that go along with this. You pick these up in school. Your whole educational process is built on this. Another is subcultural values. That's where I came from. Ham and Eggs is a great breakfast. Tremendous breakfast. Well, where I ministered for the last 4 or 5 years, I learned that menudo is a great breakfast.
Menudo?
Maybe you need to tell us where you ministered for the last 4 or 5 years.
In the eastern part of Los Angeles. It's a giant Mexican-American section. Menudo is a breakfast soup made out of beef tripe. I saw a car out there. It was out there about 6 weeks ago. We've been in Texas for 2 years, or Los Angeles for 5. I was out there a few weeks ago, and I saw this car driving down the highway. Menudo, breakfast of champions. Well, I like ham and eggs. Why? Because of where I grew up in East Tennessee. Why is it right to walk like this? See, my shoulders don't move. My hips move, but I walk basically like this. My shoulders are straight. Some of my brothers walk more like this. They've got motion. See, most black people walk differently. Why?
Most of us do.
We had a black-white dialogue with USC one time, and one of a black cheerleader was on the SC cheerleading team, Blackout. A really great Dallas Christian. And she said they really had some problems in just getting their act together because of different ways of moving. Which one's right? Either one. Just go different ways. What kind of things come out of your background that influence the way you see the data of life?
Standard of living for one thing, what you consider good and clean and decent way of life, for example, fixing your house of where you live in town, things like that, compared to someone else.
Let's make it personal. What kind of things come out of your background?
When I was telling you that you have to have the best in life and blah blah blah, you know, and best necessary cost the most money, so the thing that costs the most money.
What kind of white Anglo-Saxon or white Northern European makes you?
Same.
You may not do a whole lot. What kind do you do? What kind of differences do you see there?
Well, one of the major differences I see, and this has to do with, I guess, more lifestyle here. My family, and I think many of other Mexican American families, seem to have a slower lifestyle, slower cooking, slower. Whereas the animal people seem to be moving a lot faster.
Right. These are things that we tend not to be aware of.
Well, a friend of mine just moved from this area, just brought from Chicago to Ellisville, Mississippi. He's having a big problem in that as a music therapist and as a good organized person, he needs to get everything done right now. While some of the other people on the staff are quite willing to take it, well, let's take a coffee break, you know, and just, you know, take it much easier. It's really hard for him to do that.
My friends came from Washington, Fort Worth, Texas. I said, I can't get over it. These people around here move so slow. How you doing, brother? Hello. He's gone.
Right.
We do things different. These are the kinds of things, see, that influence the way we see what's right and wrong. Personality type. Some people are excited. They're just excited. They get excited over anything, you know. A mouse! How great! Other people weep real easy. You know, a little hurt bird. and just totally destroys him. For a week or so. Now, this is a real coup. Man, nothing bothers him. The world will be falling apart and he'll be right there cracking jokes. But it influences the way we see life. Formative personal experiences, significant people to you, those who've been your images in the past, maybe crises you've gone through, existential hedonistic values. Anybody explain those?
I can explain existential, I think.
So,
that's the school of, let's say, school of thought. It's the idea that the emphasis is placed on the individual, that you exist before you become. You become what you are as you exist. It's all the emphasis is placed on a person's experience rather than on the theory behind that.
Okay. It's more of me right here, right now. That's all that's important. Just me right here, right now. Hedonistic would add what feels good to me right here, right now. You know where you get these things from? These sort of attitudes toward life, or the subtle things you pick up. Where are you getting from? Some suggestions?
The culture.
What aspects of it?
What aspects of it?
Like movies is one.
Oh, yeah. Everything. Magazines, music, yeah. Everything you come into contact with, practically.
Another thing is I see it on the professors and the teachers. Subtly, or sometimes they come right out and just force their own value system, but sort of along the lines of do what you feel is good.
You've had
to do what you
feel is good.
Commercial saying that this thing is going to make you look really good, you know, or really fine, or that you have to have this kind of car, and it's going to make you feel really good. And the main point is looking sexy or looking good or whatever.
And what they imply is that is what gets real fulfillment. I think the height of this is the slips here at commercial. You know
gusto?
Yeah. You only go around once in life, and you got to grab all the gusto you can get. Well, that implies, boy, right now is the time. It's you, right here, right now, and you better be feeling good, or you're going to be left out. Because whenever it's over. Okay, now all these things form the filter that people have. These are they are the formers of their presuppositions. Schaefer says that intellectually, you can stack all presuppositions into two categories. Is the naturalist. I think for myself, I'm open-minded. I consider the data of the universe, and I decide what I like and what I don't like, and what's true and what's not true. But I'm open-minded. Okay? The other is the supernaturalist. And he says, God is my creator, and I'm open to all truth. Two approaches to life, two fundamental approaches. One is, there is no God. And we just need to get out there and discover all we can and do the best we can, putting life together. The other, there is a God. Now notice, you can't prove that there's not one. And you can't finally, ultimately, totally prove that there is. Even if he were here in the room and physically touchable, and you could see and you walk up and hug him, there are people who would say, well, now you can't really know that he's here. And well, one day, everybody will know. All out there in the future. Schaefer says two basic presuppositions, naturalist, supernaturalist. And what he does is compare these two. Which one best explains the universe? Back to his central emphasis. All persons have presuppositions. They need to be surfaced so that we can show them that they don't work if they're atheistic. Only, this is his third thing, only
presuppositions of historic Christianity. Adequately explain. Number one, the external world especially its form and complexity. And two, the internal world. Man's own characteristics as a human being. He calls that the mannishness of man. What he means by that is man is just different from all these other things. He has desires for love, a desire for affection, a desire for significance. That's just in him. Only the presuppositions of a God who is there and all these other things really work out to explain both of these. Another thing he says is, non-Christians cannot live a life consistent with their presuppositions. Non-Christians cannot live a life consistent with their presuppositions. What does this mean? If we're going to look at this more in depth in a few minutes, it means something like this. If there is no God who is there, what does man become? Becomes pretty well zero. And nobody can live being a zero.